for that very kind introduction. Let me first thank you all for coming here. It's obviously well beyond the call of duty, I'm sure, for all of you, and in many cases, you know, often thankless. And in some cases, I know some of you had to struggle to even make it possible to come here. And what you're doing, I think, is one of the most important things we do in society. I mean, getting the next generation, educating them. Certainly at universities, we couldn't do anything without the work you do. And so, I mean, I know it's a very thankless job, and my wife's actually a high school teacher, but I knew that even before. So anyway, many thanks for, making the big effort to come here. Hopefully you learned something interesting with the hope of passing some of the excitement, some of the cutting-edge knowledge over to the next generation of discoverers. So I want to talk about harnessing quantum physics for computation, communication, and cryptography. So quantum computing, its beginnings, you can trace it back to, for one of the reasons it's extremely exciting and important, back to a thesis that was formulated in the 20th century. It started in the first part of the 20th century with Church and Turing, and with the Turing thesis, Church-Turing thesis, and it was strengthened in the late 20th century. So the stronger version that we used in the latter part of the 20th century is that a probabilistic Turing machine, which we could define rigorously, but we don't need to. It's essentially a computer that we use today, this PC, with arbitrarily expandable memory. And the for convenience, we'll give it the ability to make random coin flips. We don't know if we really need that or not, but certainly for practical purposes, we do. That any reasonable device, computing device that you could build, design and build, could be efficiently simulated by this computer. Now, I mean efficiently in a sort of mathematical sense. It would, for practical purposes, it might not be that efficient. But for the purposes of this talk and for the research that we do, that's a fair enough notion. In the sense that, sure, this is a ThinkPad, it could simulate the operations of a Mac. And how does it do that? Well, you give it a description of how your computer works. This is a finite description of the rules that your device uses to process information, and it just simulates it. And there's a bit of an overhead. It's not quite as fast, but overall, it's a pretty good simulation. There's not going to be an astronomical gap between the efficiency of your computer and my computer. If yours is going to take twice as long for a larger input, mine will take twice as long, even though it might be a bit slower. The reason we like this thesis is because it allows us to study the difficulty of problems in a much simpler, cleaner way. Right? Since these models are effectively equivalent, up to some crude measure, but that's fine, we're going to do the crude measure first, and then in practice, we're going to look at more refined measures of cost and complexity. If you want to know how hard is this problem, it doesn't matter which computer you think about it on. Right? So that allows us to develop very, very powerful theories, right? Because they're not so constrained. Pick your favorite computing model, the one that allows you to develop a very powerful theory, find the algorithm, and then we can translate it from one computer model to the other and then optimize it further. So the theory of computing, this is one of its core foundations in the latter part of the 20th century. So we like to, when we want to study something, we model it. Okay? And then in that model, we can start really asking deep questions and proving things, testing things, and so on. But we always have to remember there was that first step where there was some real thing and then we modeled it, right? So there was a real physical system underlying, there is a real physical system underlying a computer. Right? And you can't, while it's convenient to then divorce yourself from the physics, design this mathematical model and study it and do wonderful things in it, and then run it on the real physical device, you can't completely forget that there is an underlying physical device there. Okay. So this is a puzzle. Now, if you've already seen it, you know, don't blurt out the answer. But if you haven't, it's just a nice little puzzle you can even give to your students. Just to emphasize that there's always an underlying physical system. And maybe you've proved something is impossible, but then if it's really you really want to do it, maybe go back to the underlying physics and think of, was there another way, a more rich model, a more detailed model that would maybe enable it? So the problem here is there's three switches, and they're each connected to one of three light bulbs. So there's a one-to-one correspondence. Your task is to figure out, they weren't labeled. Somebody forgot to label them. You have to figure out which switch corresponds to which light bulb. Okay? But the restriction is you start off in the room with the switches. You can spend a minute there, 2 minutes there, some fixed amount of time. And then you walk into the room with the bulbs, and then you have to make your guesses. So you're not allowed to go back. So who thinks it's not possible to always get it 100% correct? Yeah. Okay, can you just sketch the argument as to why you can't possibly win this game?
Following events, right? Yeah. Like if I start with the first switch associated with the first bulb,
yeah.
Then I have two options for each yeah. switch, so I'm still in trouble.
Yeah.
I have too many branches, too many possibilities.
Yeah. So there's many ways to prove it, right? And if you work with the assumption, as she said, that, well, you're going to, you know, there's 8 possible configurations of the light switches. You know, there's so many different ways to map them, and you can easily prove that you can't possibly guess all three correctly. Okay. Now, does anybody know how to actually guess all three correctly? Okay, I think he raised his hand first.
So you turn one switch on, leave one switch off, turn the other switch on, leave it on for a bit, and then turn it off before you go in. Feel which bulb that's off is warm. And that's the way you know what the third switch goes through.
Right. So you're saying, well, he's cheating. But I mean, I didn't give you any rules, right? So in the very natural model that she defined, which is the one any you know mathematician would have defined and proved that this is impossible, it's impossible. But if you go back to the drawing board and say, well, can I take advantage of more of the underlying physics? Right? Then yes, because it's not just on or off. It can be hot or cold. Right? There's an extra degree of freedom. There's extra information I could have encoded, and he figured out a way to do that. So you can think of those light bulbs as three state systems, and then you can model it in that way, right? And you can solve this problem. And by turning it on for different amounts of time, you could have many more states: sort of warm, really warm, burning hot. You can encode even more information. That will reach a limit. There's a cost and so on. And that, you know, you can start modeling that and it gets much more complicated. Of course, we always try to model things as simply as we need to. You could model that down at the atomic level, right? And do absolutely nothing with the improve absolutely nothing, gain no insight into the problem. So that's the game. I mean, it's an art of what's the right way to model this problem? Because if you overcomplicate the model, you just can't do anything with it, right? That's why we have this crude measure of complexity of things being, you know, simulating efficiently, but doesn't mean exactly the same time. Because with this crude model, we can prove wonderful things that really say something meaningful about computation. Similarly, with the 0-1 model, you can prove things, right? And maybe this other simple model, you can prove other things, and if you overcomplicate the model, then sure, it's more accurate, but then you can't do anything useful with it. Okay. So information is physical, and over the last century, so that means you can't ignore the laws of physics, right? And information is stored in a physical medium and manipulated by some physical processes. So it's the laws of physics that dictate what you can and can't do. In information processing. Now, we normally use the classical laws. In the last century, we used the classical laws of physics. Right? They're usually a good approximation, right? They're simple and they work. So why would you go to a richer physical explanation if you don't need to? Now, we're starting to need to for computers because they're getting smaller and smaller. They're already being, a bit is already being encoded into a small number of atoms, and then quantum effects are there. Right? People are trying to figure out how to suppress them, and maybe let's not make them any smaller. Let's figure out other ways to make faster computers. Right, the so-called Moore's Law. So you need to deal with quantum theory already, whether you like it or not. But let's look at the bright side. There's new effects now. Can we use them? Can we now take them into our model and build a richer model that's more interesting, it's more exciting, that we can do more things with? So there's two effects. Actually, they're the same effect. They're just two ways of looking at it. One is the superposition principle. Anything that can be in one of two states can be in both of those states at the same time. And it's not limited to two. Anything that can be in one of several states can be in some combination of all those states at the same time. Superposition principle. Superposition principle implies the uncertainty principle. Right? Where you can't actually extract information from a system without disturbing it. The amount of information the amount of disturbance is proportional to the amount of information extracted. Now, we don't, in so-called classical systems, we never saw this disturbance because there's so much redundancy in the system, the effective measurements are very weak, and the disturbance is minimal. We don't really notice it. So the quantum world, sure, it poses some headaches for people trying to build small computers, but it gives us two new tools. It could happen. Well, that's nice, but it's, a hammer just doesn't solve every problem. It could be completely useless for computing and information processing in general. We just didn't know. Right? We didn't know. So what is one of the most classic quantum mechanical effects? We often see the two-slit experiment. Okay, that's sort of one of the prototypical examples we'll all hear. Right? So just to briefly recap the way it's traditionally explained, we have a source that spits particles out towards a screen. So this is a screen. It's a way of detecting. It detects particles. But before the screen, you have this filter, right, with two small slits. And the particle can go through one of the two slits. And if you block one slit, say you just block the one, so you cover this slit, right? The particles, if they only go through this slit, there'll be some pattern on the screen. One will hit here, another will hit here, and so on, right? So this is a three-dimensional screen. I'm going to make it, just a two-dimensional projection, right? So you're going to start accumulating statistics. You'll get some pattern, okay? And this is a very hands-on, clear picture, I think. Also, please feel free to interrupt me. We have a chalkboard and plenty of time, so I'm happy to skip some slides at the end and just answer any questions that interest people. And you can translate this into a graph. And this is the graph people will often talk about. So you can call this position the x-axis, right? This is the x-axis. And then we plot the frequency, how many particles. This is like 1, 2, et cetera. So number of clicks or hits or whatever. So you can do, I'm in the combinatorics department. I like discrete mathematics. So you can just count. You can put little boxes because everything's discrete. Ultimately, there's going to be some discrete set of detectors on the screen that will count how many particles hit each segment of the screen. Right? A lot of people like to model things with continuous mathematics. I'm a discrete mathematician. I prefer discrete, bins and count them. So there's so many hits in that bin and so many hits in this bin and so on. And if you, you know, a typical pattern might look something like this, okay? And then the continuous mathematicians will just say, well, okay, it's like this. And then instead of number of clicks, there's some probability density just to make sure it's not comprehensible. Okay, but it really, you can do the discrete thing with the clicks, okay? And I hope so far it's so good. And I could do the same thing where I cover this. Mathematicians are very absent-minded, so I'll have to forget something. I forgot the brush. You can do the same thing here, and you get some clicks all over the place, and you can plot the clicks, right? And don't take these particular details or curves or numbers seriously. This is a very qualitative description of what goes on. You get something that looks more or less the same, except shifted over because the slit's pointing this way. Right? Or we can, if you want to sort of get a qualitative picture of the curve, it looks something like this, say. And, you know, if somebody says, okay, now what if I uncover both slits and have that same beam of particles go through, well, what do you expect? Well, I expect the sum of those two distributions, right? What else could I possibly see? Right? So I see, in each box, I take the clicks on the second diagram plus the clicks on the first diagram. That's what I expect to see. If I send the same number of particles through, that's what I should see. I mean, that's the logical conclusion. But then if you do plot it, you get something that looks very different. I don't particularly remember what it is, but it's something different, okay? Which you can calculate. So it's not the sum. Oh, sorry. Sorry, I jumped ahead. So if you add those two curves, you would get something like this, two big humps and another hump. You get whatever the sum of those two. Again, it's really discrete, right? I think, you know, everything we've ever probed down to the limit, not everything, but for the most part, turned out to be discrete. So I don't know why it'll be different for, anyway. This is what you should get by normal reasoning. And then do the experiment, and you don't quite get that. You get something else. You get a very different distribution. Let's not sweat the details. You get something like this, and you're like, that doesn't make sense. Do it again. Fire the person who did it. Do it again. Get new materials. Just keep doing it, and this is what you get. Okay? So you get a paradox. And this is a mystery, as Feynman put it. He called it the mystery of quantum mechanics. We don't understand it, but we can tell you how it works. Now, I hope this was sort of a sufficiently simple recap of this. I'm actually going to explain it in a little more detail. But this isn't actually where I would start to teach quantum mechanics to students. So I'll give you the experiment I prefer, which is a much simpler version of this. This picture on the left, on the right, is a recent article where they very weakly probed which of the two paths the particle took and got a rough picture. That should look something like this curve here. Again, they did it. This is a 2D sort of slice, but they mapped sort of a 3D picture of which paths the photons take. So, I mean, the uncertainty principle says that if somebody is actually, you know, you get this pattern, right? And you're trying to figure out what's going wrong. So you put a probe to tell you which slit each particle takes, because you're trying to do, you know, debug now. You're trying to debug your experiment. Well, you get these statistics back. Right? So if you put a little spy at those slits to tell you which way the particle, just to tell you which way it went, and in no other way touch those particles, you'll go back to this distribution. So that's a puzzle that quantum mechanics explains. So we have this richer theory called quantum mechanics, which I'll tell you about. It's a much better approximation to physics. So what does that tell us about computation? The probabilistic Turing machine, or essentially this computer, is implicitly a classical device. We model the computing power of classical physics, design this ideal computing model, here's an instantiation of it, there you go. It completely ignores quantum theory. It turns out that if you build a device out of quantum components, these computers are really, really bad at simulating them. They can't efficiently simulate them. They're exponentially bad at simulating them, as far as we know. We don't have rigorous theorems for that, but we have very high confidence that there's no efficient simulation of a simple quantum computer using a classical computer. So we seem to have violated the strong Church Turing thesis. The only hitch might be, well, maybe it's not a realistic model of computation. Maybe it's just a fantasy model of computation. There's some hidden exponential cost. But we don't think so. I mean, we've studied that really, really hard. We're building up bigger and bigger implementations. There's no real evidence that there's a fundamental reason that it's not a realistic computer. I'm not suggesting we're done and we're home free and we're 100% sure, but there's no really good reason to be skeptical except for the fact that we have a long way to go. So you can never be sure. When you extrapolate a theory, sure, something might go wrong, right? But nobody's formulated a better theory that explains why what will go wrong. But the idea behind the Church Turing thesis is extremely sound, right? Except you need to talk about a quantum computer, right? The idea, and this is the way David Deutsch put it, is for any physical theory, any physical framework, there exists a computing model that captures the power of that physical theory. And if you capture the computing power of that physical theory, well, then you can simulate any other computer designed in that theory. So this universal computer can efficiently simulate any other computer. But this computer you have to make an effort to make sure it captures the computing power of that physical theory. So you need to define a quantum computer, and that's what David Deutsch did. And we believe, there's no evidence to the contrary, that a quantum computer, or a quantum Turing machine, for a more formal definition, can efficiently simulate any realistic model of computation in the usual quantum mechanical paradigm that we work in today. Of course, somebody might invent another next generation breakthrough for physics where we say, yeah, quantum theory was a good approximation, but we have this much richer theory, and then you'd have to say, okay, now what's the computing power of this theory? Is it the same as a quantum computer? Is it more? Is it less? Right? My guess is it'll probably be the same, maybe more. I find it skeptical that I'm skeptical that it would be less, but we don't know. But I mean, I personally don't expect a major shift from quantum theory anytime soon. I've talked a lot about computation. We could also talk about communication. When you communicate information, you encode it in some physical system. This thing is quantum. So if you encode it in a system where you can actually exploit the quantum effects, maybe you can do things that you previously couldn't do. So if one thing you can do is if you encode your bit in a quantum particle, is if an eavesdropper looks at it, they're gonna really mess it up. Right? If you encode it in a big classical system, so-called classical system, they could look at it, the disturbance will be really minimal, you won't see it. But if you encode it in a tiny quantum system, if they look at it, they have to disturb it. So you get eavesdropper detectability. You also get the potential to, you know, there's all these distributed computing costs, right? Information is scattered around the internet, around the world, and we sometimes need to compute something which is a function of the information there and here, right? Of course, I could take all the information here, send it over the internet to you, you solve the problem, and then send it, you know, well, you don't have to send it back because you can copy classical information. But that's really expensive. Can you do it with less communication? And if you exploit the quantum mechanical properties of nature, you often can. You can even exponentially reduce communication for certain problems. Okay, quantum communication, quantum computation doesn't magically speed up everything, but it does speed up some important things. So do you have any questions about the preamble so far? If not, I'll... Yes?
For the first experiment, we know from optics that the single slit gives you a double width, maximum, central maximum.
Okay.
And very wide, very intense, whereas the double slit gives you equal maximum. So
okay.
Where do you want to imply that it could be a different pattern?
Sorry?
We know that the Young experiment gives you equal maxima. Why do you want to suggest?
You mean you're saying my drawing wasn't?
Yes.
So I don't mean to suggest anything that contradicts. So these should be. I meant to draw something symmetric.
Right. They should be equal height.
Yeah.
But
in the traditional.
So that you want to imply that it could be anything.
Oh, you could. You could cook up if you could. I mean, if you put things at those slits. You could put small quantum computers or fancy lenses at these slits
and
really play with the probabilities.
Okay.
And then you could draw nice pictures on the screen. And yeah, that's so. And when you're teaching students, if you want to avoid complex numbers, you could lie to them. That was Feynman's advice. and just cook up, amplitudes that don't have complex numbers in them. You won't get these nice pictures. You'll get boring pictures. But I mean, at least they can take 1 minus 1 and get 0. But I minus I might, if they're not allowed, if they don't know what I is. Then, so you could lie to them. But I mean, every lie opens up another, so I mean, you're the experts on teaching. So, but you could, in principle, put funny stuff here and get stuff that satisfies quantum theory, has similar sort of paradox, but different pictures, and maybe simpler to explain to students. Potentially, it's a trade-off. Because you could define it more simply, but then it's not explaining the traditional two-slit experiment. But it's, I would say, conceptually the same thing, but avoids complex numbers and trig functions. So this experiment, which is my favorite way to explain quantum theory, and for those of you at Lucy and Hardy's talk, you would have seen similar ideas. Doesn't have to involve complex numbers. Roberta, in an older version, was asking me, but why is this thing asymmetric? And I was like, it was asymmetric because I wanted to avoid complex numbers. So I added the complex numbers back in and made it symmetric. But maybe if you're teaching it to high school students, we could go back to the previous version where I avoid complex numbers altogether and just stick to real numbers. So you can do all of this with only real numbers. The smart students will say, but why is it asymmetric? And then you have to lie to them. Or I mean, you can tell them the truth, but I mean, you can, in principle, rig the equipment to do exactly the real amplitude explanation. It's just, I like the symmetry of what I'm going to tell you right now. So a beam splitter, you have a source of particles. Usually we say photons, but this works with anything. But with cats, it starts to get really hard technologically. But with electrons, neutrons, and so on, this sort of stuff is done fairly routinely. So you send this particle of light through a beam splitter. In the old days, it was a half-silvered mirror. So it was just a piece of glass with silver on it. Now, if it's fully silvered, it's a mirror. It reflects the light 100%. If you put a little less silver on it, it's half silvered, and what happens? Well, sometimes the light gets reflected, and sometimes it goes straight through. If you just keep repeating it again and again and again, you'll notice roughly 50-50 statistics if you put the right amount of silver in there. Now, I have a beam splitter here, and you'll notice there's no silver in it. You can come look at it later. They just take two pieces of glass, glue them together, cut it into a cube. It has the same properties. You don't need quantum physics to explain this, right? You can come up with any harebrained explanation you like. There's lots of good explanations. It doesn't have to be harebrained, actually. There's very simple, elegant, believable explanations for how this works. It doesn't involve any quantum theory. Pick your favorite one. There isn't you know, there's a bit of silver here, a bit of silver there, the material's jiggling around, it, you know, there's a 50% chance you'll hit a silver molecule and get reflect, whatever. You can easily come up with very believable explanations. Okay? But let me set up this slightly more complicated apparatus, which would resemble what Lucien Hardy showed you earlier. So the particles. So basically, here's a regular half-silvered mirror that I just described, or beam splitter. So a particle is going this way, we know, gets split 50-50. Any particle going this way gets split 50-50. Right? And this beam splitter is also a 50-50 beam splitter, but it doesn't actually matter. But, well, it does matter for the next slide. But for this prediction, what is the probability that you should get a particle here? You should detect a photon. Again, each individual, we're talking about single particles of light. If you have continuous wave, you know, beam of light, you could start using some sort of complicated wave arguments. But we're talking about single quanta of light or electrons. Yes?
You would assume it would be 50-50.
It should be 50%, right? So it's easy to verify with, you know, straightforward reasoning. Okay. So you should get 50-50. Do the experiment, and you always get the detections here. I mean, within experimental error, of course, but it's always.
Where's the gremlin?
Sorry?
Where's the gremlin?
The gremlin, okay, exactly. Where's the gremlin? So the simplest explanation has to be wrong. With a sufficiently complex gremlin, you can actually explain this away. But let me give you a gremlin-free explanation. And it sort of looks like this. In an actual experimental table, you have a laser shining light. Now, this intensity should go down by 50%, which you don't really see in this cartoon, but right? And then the light always comes out there. And you could play with this. If you put your hockey stick or anything here, what you'll notice is half of the photons hit the hockey stick, like you expect, and the other half, what happens? So what's the probability of getting a photon up here if I stick a hockey stick in the way? 50, right? So it's 50 of those 50. So you get 50% of the photons hit the hockey stick, and then 25-25 get split up there, which is weird because there's these particles. They're just one after the other, boom, 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 boom. They're always coming out here. I steal some of them, and suddenly the photon that would have gone here now has to decide to go there. Right? And you can start inventing gremlins. While the photon is looking ahead, it sees the hockey stick, right? And it knows that it should take a left turn with 50% probability. And then you're like, well, I'm going to wait till the last minute. I'm not going to put the hockey stick down until the photon has already decided which way it's going to go. Aha! And then you're like, well, no, I'm going to, yeah, so. And then you can say, oh, but I got a really sophisticated, not only is there a gremlin, there's invisible particles that, you know, go through and tell, you know, go through the hockey stick. And, you know, you can invent complicated explanations. But there's another experiment which will rule out those. But let's forget about complicated explanations that we probably don't believe. And let me give you the simplest explanation given by quantum theory. And this is a picture of an actual bench, a colleague in Singapore. And if you actually go to, if you took the lab tour with Martin Laforêt, you'll see that no optical table looks that neat and tidy. Right? That's what, it looks more like this. And this is a tiny one. So this is the same apparatus, more or less, that Antia had set up in Singapore. So this is something we can see in the labs. Now the only cheat here is this is a continuous beam of light. But in principle, you could turn down this source to be one single, you know, just be spitting out a very, very gentle, occasional spray of single photons. Occasionally two or three, but, right, and usually nothing. And you could have very, very, very sensitive photon counters here and do this experiment. The difference is, the only difference is, it's a lot slower, and the photon counters are more expensive. But you get the same results, same statistics as you do with the high intensity beam. So how do we explain this? Well, the usual, lets us model our classical reasoning. Right? Initially, we said, well, each photon takes one of the two paths with 50% with probability a half, and then it takes another, makes another choice with probability a half each way. And there's four possible outcomes: 0, 1, you know, 0 along one path, 0 along the other path. If I label each detector as 0 or a 1, there's two ways to get to the 0 detector, and there's two ways to get to the 1 detector. Okay. And they each occur with probability, well, a half for the first choice and a half times a half for the second choice. So the probability of each path is a half times a half is a quarter. I'm rushing through probability theory here. You would go a little slower, with students. But, I mean, this is, I think that probably would get this. Right? And then the so each path takes probability a quarter, happens with probability a quarter, and then you say, what's the probability of getting a zero outcome? Well, you go through all the ways you can get a zero outcome and add up those probabilities. So it's probability a quarter of getting a zero this way and probability a quarter of getting a zero that way. So it's probability, with probability a quarter, the photon went straight through both times. With probability a quarter, got reflected and then reflected again. Right? That's what those two paths are. And you use this reasoning and you get the 50-50 outcome prediction, which is wrong. Quantum theory says, well, you don't quite have probabilities. You have quantum probability amplitudes. Here I just loosely call them quantum probabilities. And they're essentially the square roots of the probabilities. So quantum theory tells us there's a richer, slightly richer mathematics underlying probability theory, where each probability is really, there's a quantum amplitude, which is a square root. To get the probability, it's no problem. Just take the absolute value squared. In order to make it nice and symmetric, I introduce I, the square root of minus 1. But you can do essentially the same explanation without introducing complex numbers if you prefer. Right? And the way you could, now, if instead of, so if you take the absolute value squared of all these numbers, you get the usual classical probabilities of a half. Right? Absolute value of I is 1. So absolute value of I over root 2, if you square it, it's going to be a half. The difference is, the probability amplitude of getting 0 this way is 1 over root 2 times 1 over root 2, which is 1 over 2. And here you get I squared over 2. So I squared is minus 1. So the probability of getting 0, the probability amplitude of getting 0 is a half plus minus a half. Well, that's 0. Squared, that's still 0. So I see 0 with probability 0. And this is how you can explain the interference in that, what's called the Mach-Zehnder interferometer, in that interferometry experiment. Right? So you get a zero. Let's call this path zero. So the photons going this way are called, are in the zero state. Any photon going this way is in the one state. So it starts off in the zero state. After it goes through the beam splitter, it's in the zero state with probability probability amplitude 1 over root 2. And in the one state with amplitude I over root 2. Whatever that means. Okay, I'm not pretending that should, this should make sense necessarily. So in some meaningful way, it's in 0 and 1 with these quantum probability amplitudes. And we shouldn't lie to students and tell them, what do you mean you don't get it? It is supposed to be a bit unusual, at least when you first see it. I think it's something you just eventually get used to. But certainly the first time you see it, I mean, this is the question everyone, people always say, well, the mathematics I get, I just don't know what it means. I'm like, I don't either. Like Feynman said, it's a mystery, we don't understand it, we'll just tell you how it works. And my advice to students is just use it. Figure out how it works. And then, of course, then start thinking deeper about what it means and how you want to interpret it. If you choose to. But I mean, you don't need to actually do things with it. So it starts off, so after the beam splitter, it's in this combination of 0 and 1. And then just before it reaches that beam splitter, it's still in the same combination of 0 and 1. And then what happens? So some really simple algebra. So we already agreed. Well, I don't, you didn't actually agree, but I'll take it that you agree that 0 goes to 1 over root 2, 0, plus I over root 2, 1, whatever that means. Okay. And by a symmetry, argument. Okay. 1 should go to the same thing except swapping the role of 0 and 1. This is the whole reason I introduced the I again. So you could have a nice symmetric. But if you don't care about the symmetry, you can actually get rid of I. So I 1 goes to multiply both sides by I. So it's just it's kind of the algebra we're used to in high school. So this I becomes I squared, so it's minus 1. And this 1 becomes I. Right? So 0 goes to this. I 1 goes to this. So what does this go to? Okay, well, Well, 1 over root 2, 0 will go to, let's multiply both sides by 1 over root 2. So this becomes 2. 2, and, so that's what 1 over root 2, 0 goes to. That's what I over root 2, 1 goes to. And what does their sum go to? Well, it's got to go to the sum. What else could it possibly go to, right? It goes to this. This is sum of all these terms. Right, so what the heck is this? Well, a half 0 minus a half 0. It's probably going to be 0, 0, plus I over 2 times I over 2. So 2i over 2, which is I, 1. And we don't usually keep around terms with a 0 in front of them. Right, you get I, 1. The arithmetic is fairly easy, and you can even get rid of the i's if you like. So you get I 1. Okay. And that I must be bothering you. We'll get rid of it in a second. Okay. There's that rule I told you that when you look at something, the probability of seeing it is its amplitude squared. Absolute value. So the absolute value of I squared is just the absolute value of minus 1 is 1. So it doesn't matter, because I has the same size, same length as 1. So you see, this value 1, so that's why I put it in quotes, with probability 1. And physicists, instead of quotes, they used, Dirac invented Dirac, his notation that looks like that. So this funny Dirac notation, as far as I'm concerned, it's just there. So you can distinguish when you're talking about a label for a state from a quantum probability amplitude. Otherwise, how do you distinguish 1, 1? How do you distinguish this 1, which is the amplitude of the probability, from the label? Because we happen to be using the same numbers. So in physics, they use this Dirac notation. But really, it's just a way of distinguishing labels for states from probabilities, probability amplitudes. This is the essence of quantum theory. If you understand this, if you pretend to understand, or if you just get used to this, you pretty much got used to quantum theory. And it's the same essence that the two-slit experiment explains. Now, if you want to really explain the actual two-slit experiment, it helps to consider this experiment where you put in a phase shift. So in this experiment, each photon, whether it goes this way or that way, travels the same path length. It's like in the two slit where these, we're talking about this spot here, where these guys have traveled exactly the same length, right? And things interfere, you know, constructively. But over here, one photon has taken a longer path than the other. You start to get so-called phase shift between them. So you can get, you can put a phase shift in this device too if you want to step it up a notch and explain these phase shifts and these different patterns. You can. I'm not. You might not want to, at least not initially. But you know, you get the same stuff, and then that phase shift adds a phase parameter there, which again was probably more for the advanced students. And then you could. It's not, the arithmetic is not that advanced. You just need trigonometry. But you do the calculation and you get a pattern which is cos squared phi, so that the effective length, the effective phase shift there, cos squared phi over 2. So if you didn't put the mirror, if you didn't put this piece of glass there, phi is 0, cos squared of 0 is 1. So that's a good sanity check. We get back what we know. And if you start putting in a really thin piece of glass, this, you get a bit of detection here, and if you put in a thick enough piece of glass, you get 100% here. Right? And so that's how you can actually get rid of the eyes if you'd like. You just implicitly stick, you know, make, you know, change the path lengths a little bit. You never see those eyes, and you can make everything with real numbers. Yep.
This pi over 2 can be derived from sine squared pi over 2 cosine squared pi over 2. If you do the trigonometry of adding the amplitudes, and because the intensity is the square proportional to the square of the amplitudes. So that's where it actually comes from.
Right. So yeah, so I mean, if you...
It's not something completely impossible or impossible
to
get with real numbers.
Yeah. So the way you, I mean, the way you get it is essentially you get 1 over 2, you get 1 plus e to the I phi over 2, right? Which you can write as e to the I phi over 2 e to the minus I, sorry, phi over 2 plus e to the I phi over 2 over 2, right? And then and you expand this, you know, cos phi over 2 plus I, or minus I sine phi over 2. That's what this is. And you expand the other one, and you get cos phi over 2 plus I sine phi over 2 divided by 2. So the sines cancel out. The two coses cancel out with this. So you get e to the I phi over 2 cos phi over 2. And then when you take the absolute value squared, this thing has norm 1, has length 1, and this is, gives you the cos squared. So it's not, I mean, you could do it. I mean, especially with students who wouldn't be afraid of this. It's certainly not beyond high school students, but you might not want to do it.
Sorry, can I actually go back 2 slides? The one you know, is that the Schrodinger's wave or what we're representing, does that equal in both lines now, or is that one representing the phase shift that's going through one of them? Is that pointing to that part of the wave specifically?
Yeah, this I, you mean?
Yeah.
This I is goes to the part of the wave that was reflected.
Okay.
So yeah, this is the one path now. So that's sort of the rule. If it get, when it gets reflected, it picks up that I.
So the one that goes through, what's it look like? The other yellow one at the bottom.
It's the zero.
It's the zero. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. Sorry, you didn't make that. Thanks for asking. Yeah, so the zero is, this is the zero path, and this is the one path.
You did say that.
Yeah, well, it's, I should have written it out because, you know, it's a distraction.
So the zero path is on the bottom.
Yeah.
So when you go to the next slide, then. Oh, sorry, maybe a couple slides before when you did the new reconciliation. So that one there.
Yeah. So this was just the same. It's in 1 over root 2, it went straight through. With I over root 2 amplitude, it reflected. And then here, it's the same thing. They're just a little, you know, they're just about to go through the beam slitter. Nothing really has happened yet. And then once it goes through the beam slitter, you combine them in that way. So how does this connect to the two? I said this as he sent you. I've just explained the two slit experiment. Does anybody want to? So I don't have enough. Initially, I was going to actually go through a detailed, so an intermediate calculation, sort of a modified two slit experiment, one where effectively I cheated, I put some funny lenses here to change the probabilities so I could make them all cancel out really nicely in exactly the same way the Mach-Zehnder does. But I don't have time to do that. But essentially, the way the connection between this and the two slit experiment is each point, you know, in the Mach-Zehnder, there's two detectors, 0 and 1. So this is like the one, you can think of this as the one detector, but then there's another, you know, 1, and then there's a 2, and then a 3. There's a lot of detectors, right? N, and so on. The probability of hitting any particular detector here, there's two ways to get there. You either go this way, or you go this way. So there's two paths. They each have their own amplitude. You add up the amplitudes. And in the proper two slit experiment, the difference between the amplitudes corresponds to the difference in these path lengths. So when they're exactly the same, they add up constructively. And when they're off by the right amount, they'll add up completely destructively. But when you keep going, it starts to add up constructively again, and it oscillates. Right. So the two slit experiment, in my opinion, is just a more complicated form of that interference experiment. Where instead of just two detectors, you have to explain a whole wall's worth of detectors, and the amplitudes are more complicated. Because it's not just they add up constructively or completely cancel out. You have to consider everything in between. So it's the same phenomenon. Just, I think, a simpler example of it. So the way I like to think of quantum theory, it's not so much a new theory of physics in the traditional sense. It's more a new mathematical paradigm for physics. A nice analogy is if you're trying to draw a map, right? You know, you would, in the old days, you would just assume the Earth is flat and keep, you know, you draw a map of Waterloo and Kitchener, Toronto, and all these other places, and you would draw them on a flat surface. And just glue them together, that would be your model. It would work fine until you tried to draw a map of the whole Earth or a big chunk of it, then it just wouldn't work. You'd start getting paradoxes and you'd start coming up with crazy explanations. And then, you know, it would just get uglier and it just wouldn't work and the predictions would be wrong and so on. Until you say, well, what if instead of working on a flat surface, I work on the surface of a sphere? And then the mathematics is not that much harder, but everything works. Right. Predictions are correct. Everything fits together nicely. So quantum theory, 100 years ago, over 100 years ago, there were the few puzzles left in physics. They just couldn't quite figure them out. And what they needed, most of them, were, I mean, obviously there's still a problem with gravity and other parts of theoretical physics. But most of these paradoxes 100 years ago were resolved very cleanly and are being tested to exquisite precision in a quantum mechanical paradigm. And it's just a new mathematical paradigm in which to write, express physical theories. So maybe you don't believe me. Maybe you think I still prefer the gremlins. The way you really rule out almost any reasonable theory is to try to play this game. Okay, this is a nice game you could even give to your students, and they can play against each other. So there's two parties, Alice and Bob. In fact, you can have several students. There's, in fact, a challenger. You can have two challengers and an Alice and a Bob. So, you know, four students could play this game where the challenger gives Alice and Bob each a bit S, gives Alice S and Bob a bit T. So a 0 or a 1. But Alice and Bob have to be separated, okay? So you can space-like separate them, but obviously maybe it's not practical in your school. But they just have to be in separate rooms and can't communicate, so no phones. But space-like separation guarantees they can't communicate. But it just suffices that you somehow guarantee that there's no communication. They can conspire in advance all they like, right? But they just can't communicate. And then Alice and Bob have to output a bit. So Alice gets a challenge, right? It's one of two challenges. She has to answer 0 or 1, true or false. Okay, you can, any two-bit output's fine, so you could get creative. And Bob has to do the same. He doesn't know what challenge Alice is getting. Alice doesn't know what challenge he's getting. And they win if they always output the same answer, except when they both get 1. So here's the input. So they either both get 0s, one gets a 0, the other gets a 1, or vice versa. In those three cases, they have to output the same bit. We don't care what bit it is. So it's easy to win the game 3 times out of 4 by just always output 0, and then they win. But if they both get 1, they have to output a different bit. 1, 0, and the other 1. And that's why it's good to have the other students play the referees, play the challengers. Because if Alice and Bob, you know, get cheeky and just always output 0, because the challengers don't have to randomly pick their challenges. They can also conspire. Okay? So if you know Alice and Bob are always outputting 0s, well, then you always ask them 1, 1. Right? And have the students play back and forth. And what do you think, if you know, the students will eventually converge to? Where they're both playing adversarially. The challengers can hear Alice and Bob's plans, but Alice and Bob don't hear what the challengers are going to do. If those are the rules of the game and you let the students play this, what will they converge to? What will be the winning? How often will Alice and Bob win? But then the challengers will challenge them with 1-1. And then they'll lose all the time. So it's a fun game, because then they'll play that and they'll lose. They'll think, well, that wasn't fun. And then they'll switch to a different strategy. There's a nice randomized strategy, actually, where Alice and Bob, they can always win 3 out of the 4 times. Right? So always answering 0 or always answering 1 wins these 3 times. But then the adversaries can always pick 1-1. But they can also find a strategy where they win the other 3 times and always lose here, or always lose here, or always lose there. And if they randomly pick those 4 strategies, there's nothing the adversaries can do other than play fair. I mean, they might as well play fair. So there's actually a very famous theorem, Cyrilson's theorem, that says the best you could ever do, Alice and Bob could ever do against these adversaries is win against, you know, smart adversaries, is win 75% of the time. So does the game make sense?
No, I don't understand. Okay. When you say they have to report A equal to B, but the inputs are different. So
they don't. So Alice gets an input and she announces A. Bob gets an input, he announces B. If what they announce is the same.
So the announcement is not the same with the input?
No, it's a different, Alice and Bob, they can pick a, like Alice could announce the opposite of what she was given, or the same, or she could always output 0, or always output 1, or flip a coin. So she gets an input, and then she can do whatever she wants. She can answer whatever she wants after. It can depend on the input, it cannot depend on the input.
So how can they win in 0-1 if they don't cheat? One of them has to cheat, right?
No.
When the input is 0-1.
Oh, 0-1. Oh, there's a different strategy that would let them win. So you're saying how can they win in these 3 categories but not 0-1?
Yeah.
I'd have to think about the game. But it's something like Alice outputs her input and Bob always outputs 1. So there's not, you can easily, I mean not easily, but I mean it's fun. You can actually devise a strategy that does that. So I better ramp it up. But the bottom line is, if Alice and Bob, with classical reasoning, you can prove they can never win more than 75% of the time. Okay. But if they share this entangled state, so it's a superposition of both having zero and both having one, and they have quantum apparatus, they can actually win 85% of the time, more than 85% of the time. Right? So if you win this game, you have a theorem that says you can't win more than 75% of the time, but you keep winning 85% of the time, then you have something to explain. And this rules out sort of the crazy gremlin theories for what's going on in the Mach-Zehnder experiment. Now, I talked about a bit being a photon here or there, but you can have polarization as a photon, as a bit, whether it's polarized this way or that way. And I don't have time, but I have some polarizers if you want to play with them after. And Martin Laforêt said, you know, if you want to play this with students, you can actually buy these small ones pretty cheaply. He builds these big ones. They're not that expensive either. So there's a nice paradox, which unfortunately I don't have time for, but you can explain it with the same mathematics that I used to explain the Mach-Zehnder experiment. You could use an atom, an ion, or an atom to encode a bit, where if it's in the ground state, it's zero. If it's in the excited state, it's a one. If you shine a laser on it for the right amount of time, you can get that same superposition. And if you shine it for the same laser for the same amount of time, you get back one. And again, reason, you know, you could easily, you shouldn't get that, because if you measure this atom, you get a random bit. Then why do you get a deterministic outcome? I mean, it defies classical reasoning, but it's the same mathematics. And if you build an array of these bits, here I just picked the atom bits for whatever reason. By shining lasers on them and letting them interact, instead of just being in a superposition of 0 and 1, these three bits can be in a superposition of all three configurations. Can be with some quantum amplitude be 1000, with some quantum amplitude 111, and so on. These numbers I just picked randomly. They're real. There's no imaginary numbers here, but in general they can be complex. And if you square them and add them up, you should get 1 within round off error. So you can get anything of this sort. So why is it hard to simulate a quantum computer? What if I had 4 bits? Or 8 bits? Or 100 bits? There's 2 to the 100 configurations. I can't write down 2 to the 100 numbers on a classical computer. Right? Now there might be, if there's enough symmetry and structure in the problem, there's efficient simulations. But in general, we don't know how to simulate these much better than just writing down all the amplitudes. So we think we have a more powerful model of computation, right? And there's some famous problems that underlie digital security. If you do online banking, online shopping, you don't send your credit card unencrypted on the internet. You first negotiate a key with Amazon or whatever company it is you're dealing with or your bank, and then you send the confidential information. The security of these codes depends on certain mathematical problems being hard, such as factoring a large number into its prime components. We think it's hard because it takes this ugly number, this really large number worth of steps to break on a classical computer using the best known algorithms. But on a quantum computer, if you take advantage of these quantum devices, the quantum mechanics, you can solve that same problem with much, much fewer steps. It's not a clock speed question. It's saying we don't need that many steps. It's just a few steps, almost as complex as encoding. That's the complexity of breaking those codes. So I won't have time to discuss this. But somebody asked, how close are we to building a quantum computer? Well, we don't know. But I can say there's steady progress. Both the theory people are saying, well, do we really need, if we have perfect quantum devices, we're done. We know what we're doing. We know how to do it. But we'll never have perfect quantum devices. So theorists are saying, well, what if they're almost perfect? Okay, what if they're even worse than that? And they're pushing what they can do with noisy quantum apparatus. And they're getting better and better at getting more out of noisier and noisier systems. From the other end, the experimentalists are getting better and better at controlling quantum mechanical systems. So you can go to Nature and Science, which are top publications in physics, and get, even in the last 6 months or 12 months, major advances. So here, 2 orders of magnitude improvement in the decoherence time. So these quantum bits, they survive 200 times longer than they did before. Right? And that's one small step forward. Right? They couldn't do single-shot readout of an electron spin in silicon until a few months ago. Right? So it's another tool in the tool chest. Are we there yet? No, but we're getting closer. Right? 5 years ago, they entangled, again, with not great fidelity, but they entangled two ions that were a meter apart. And recently, they do error correction. They've entangled 14 qubits in an ion trap. They've coupled light to a qubit in a diamond, and so on. So superconducting circuits. They have a superposition of current going this way or going that way. So it seems like a macroscopic system, but you can see, and it is and it isn't, but you can see quantum effects there. Yep.
So is the hard part putting the quantum information in accurately, or is it reading the information once you put it in, or is it a little bit of both?
It's at least one of the above, and different systems have different problems.
Yeah.
So you have to do all those steps with high fidelity, and in most systems you can do one of those steps at least with high fidelity. But can you do? And the control is another thing. How do you flip the bits without messing them up with high fidelity?
What is the when you say a noisy system? What makes the system noisy? Is it a vibration? Is the fact that there's stray photons? Is the fact that you've got a leak of electrons in your devices? What's causing the noise in the system that...
It's all, everything you mentioned and more. Okay. So it's just the fact, like what makes a classical computer noisy? Well, we're very good at shielding them, but it's always interacting with the rest of the universe. Okay. And you kind of have to... You can never perfectly shield them. You just shield them enough for the length of the computation you hope to do. Okay. So you always have to do some kind of error correction. Even for classical computers, we usually avoid it, but if you want long-term memories or... If you're communicating in a noisy environment, you need error-correcting codes.
Would a lower temperature be better, or where is temperature?
Usually it's better. You know, a better isolation is usually better. But often, what one thing that helps one aspect makes another aspect harder. So if you, there's qubits that are tremendously well-isolated, then they're really hard to read out. So there's often trade-offs, and we're really playing this really exquisite balancing act. But we're, you know, moving forward. We're getting better and better at all these things. But it's really... It's all the above, and precision. You have to, you know, shine, you know, some of these things go gigahertz, 10 gigahertz rate, so you need pretty precise control. And
what about the cost efficiency?
The cost efficiency?
The cost efficiency, yes. Is it worth designing something like that?
So I'll skip the quantum cryptographic tools, but there are, we can also exploit, I'll get to that in a second then.
Maybe in the
answer. I'm almost there, so.
We have to cut the time because the next guy has to come in.
Okay. So you can build these unbreakable codes by exploiting the Heisenberg uncertainty principle. And we're looking at achieving global distances using satellites or small quantum computers as repeaters. But is it worth it? Well, what is it good for? Of course, we don't want to build them to break codes. We're trying to build them to solve all these other important mathematical problems. You can speed up general searching and optimization, which has applications across all of engineering and physics and science. You can simulate complicated quantum mechanical systems. You can build better sensors. You could say, well, if these things are so fragile, maybe that means they're really good at sensing things. So you can have, you know, have better measures of time, for example, and so on. But I think for the most part, the applications haven't even been imagined yet. So what we already know is amazing, and I think well worth the investment. But there's much more that we haven't even discovered yet. Right. Yeah. So one application of quantum, Professor Turek and my other colleagues, they invent these very sophisticated quantum mechanical theories to explain all sorts of physical phenomena. But then how do you test the theory? Because they're quantum mechanical in nature. We can't simulate them on classical computers in general. And with a quantum computer, we can really, when we have them, we can push forward the testing of all these other theories that we study here at the Perimeter Institute.
Well, I'd like to thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.